We're back. So, please.
It's the version I have. Send me that.
Okay, so good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for having me for this talk at AITP. I'm very grateful. So my name is Oishik Ghosh, and this, so if you haven't noticed from the title of the talk already, this is going to be about particle physics and AI. So and hopefully we can have some exchange of ideas and maybe have some common interests that we can discuss later. So the history of particle physics and AI goes back a long way, using primitive neural networks and stuff. But some of the recent milestones are the Higgs ML challenge. It was a Kaggle challenge to find the Higgs boson, something we discovered in 2012, with greater precision using machine learning. And in fact, it became the launching pad for the XGBoost algorithm, which a lot of us use nowadays. More recently, just last year, we had another challenge called the TrackML challenge. Here, the problem was a bit more difficult. So you see in the middle, this is like a picture of a particle detector. And you have, we're smashing particles right at the center of the detector. And what happens when you do this at high energy is that it creates all kinds of new particles that go out at the speed of light in all possible directions. But the detector is, of course, discrete, so it doesn't measure the entire continuous line. It measures points. So you, at the end, you get this point cloud, and you have to figure out which points come from the same track, so the same particle moving out at the speed of light. And this is quite a tricky task. But you would think that since it's a very typical pattern recognition problem, you have points, and you have about like millions of points and about thousands of lines to connect them. Machine learning should be an ideal solution for this. But in fact, the Kaggle challenge ended with the winner actually using barely any machine learning, and the machine learning solution didn't really weren't all that successful, which is interesting. So there are still pattern recognition problems that current machine learning is not so good at. Now the latest milestone is probably the American NSF has announced a MIT-led Institute for Artificial Intelligence and Fundamental Interactions. It's like a permanently marrying the two fields. In particle physics, we have one advantage, which is that we don't really. Apart from like data collected from the world, we can actually start modeling everything from just a mathematical expression. So the expressions you see on the right is the same thing is also on my t-shirt, basically. With this little expression, you can essentially explain the entire world apart from maybe quantum gravity and dark matter. But this can explain almost everything you experience in daily life, in principle. So you start from just like how do particles interact, and you can build up. But if you actually try to do this calculation very quickly, it becomes intractable and you can't do the computation. So instead, we are able to simulate this using Monte Carlo techniques. The last piece of this is called the standard model of particle physics. And the last piece to be discovered was the Higgs boson, which gives other particles their mass. But since we're looking at these tiny particles, we have to take into account quantum mechanics. And I'm going to show you a cartoon of one particular complication of quantum mechanics, which is called quantum interference. So as you, let's say you have this guy and he has two ways he can go, and he makes this decision based on by flipping a coin. Right, so there are two places, but we know that maybe you've heard of the Schrodinger cat problem, that if you don't make a measurement, then the guy is there at both places simultaneously. Now, if you take this this a step further, and you say that he's going to flip another coin and take one of two other possible steps, then you have three possible final states. Two ways, two paths of getting to the one at the center, and one path each to go to the extreme. You would think that the guy would end up at the center more often, but what you might actually have is that the two versions of himself collide and interfere with each other, and therefore he's not able to reach the central point at all. And in fact, the probability of him reaching the positions is 50% for the extremes and zero for the central position. So this is like a cartoon explanation for quantum interference. But we will see a more realistic version of it very soon. But what do we do at CERN? So at CERN, we have the Large Hadron Collider, which is this about 22 kilometer long ring near Geneva. So and at various points, we have these massive detectors. So this is the detector I work with. It's called the Atlas detector, and you can see that those tiny little two red things, that's the size of a human. We take protons and we collide them in the center of the detector, and then lots of things happen. We can't see all of them because it happens really fast, but we measure the final state, what happens right at the end, and then we try to guess what happened in the middle. The data we get here is unlabeled. We need to also simulate the whole process to try to compare the simulation with the data. And the collaboration has more than 3,000 physicists and engineers who are optimizing the detector, the analysis strategy. And often you have two or three PhD students studying alternate strategies just to get a 5% improvement in the measurement. So everything is very precise. To do these simulations, you have to start with the theory, so the Lagrangian that I talked about, and then you simulate what would happen at the first instant. But so this is called parton level, but this is not something you can ever measure. Then they will shower as in create more particles, and these will actually interact with the detector. Then you need to simulate the whole detector effect. And all of this, and then you finally choose some aspects of the data that you want to see, which are called observables. And this whole thing, if you want to do it analytically, you have to solve this incredibly complicated integral, which is not possible to do, which is why we sample from it by simulation. But in the end, the objective is we want to so we have this Lagrangian, and we want to measure individual parameters of this Lagrangian in the hope that something is different from what we expect, and that will give us new physics. And the way we do it is we train off-the-shelf, often we train off-the-shelf machine learning models like neural networks or BDTs. So it takes various aspects of the data, so maybe 50 features, and condenses all of that information into one feature, so kind of like a summary statistic. And the training is done simply by signal versus background training, so Higgs events, interactions versus not Higgs interactions. And then, for example, then you do a maximum likelihood fit. So if you have different distributions, then you say whatever distribution you get from the data will match more the one value of the parameter compared to another. Here, I give an example of a parameter that I call mu, which represents something in the theory. Right, now this entire analysis takes many physicists and many months to optimize. And nonetheless, the entire thing is done only using simulations from one value of the parameter, which is the standard model, the baseline value. And then you hope that whatever you optimize here works just as well everywhere else. And usually that is the case, unless you have the quantum interference that I was mentioning. So quantum interference says that if you have an initial state and a final state, all possible paths in the middle will happen, and they will in fact interfere with one another, like we saw in the cartoon earlier. So if you have an observation of one collision, and you think maybe it came from a Higgs process, so there is a probability to get this from a Higgs process, let's say PS, but there's also a probability that it came from some non-Higgs process, PB. And because these terms are complex numbers, you actually end up getting this mixed term, which means that the probability is influenced by a strange concept of it comes both from the Higgs and not from the Higgs simultaneously. So now if it's very difficult to train a classifier because you don't have any meaning of class labels. You can't say that half the events are Higgs and half are non-Higgs because they all come from Higgs and they all don't come from Higgs at the same time. And this introduces various kinds of non-linearities. Like you would expect that if you increase the signal strength, which means you increase the amount, like interaction of the Higgs, you expect to see more Higgs. But in fact, that's what you get in the orange line. But if you introduce interference, you see that the more you try to increase the Higgs interaction, the less Higgs you see. Until a point, and then it starts increasing again. So these kind of weird non-linearities make our typical analysis strategies like not optimal. And if you try to do it anyway, then you get these kind of weird figures. So looking at this plot, all you need to understand is that we're scanning for different values of the parameter, and the y-axis tells you how confident the analysis technique is that this value is the correct one. So all of them peak at the correct value of the signified by the golden horizontal line. But they also peak at this other value, which is very different. So instead of 0.5, it peaks at around 2.5. And the different colors are the different ways of doing this analysis. And they all peak at slightly different points. So the wrong values are slightly different, but the right value is always the same. And the only way, like one way to fix this is then you have to go back and re-optimize the entire analysis that took you months so that you can break this degeneracy, so that you can differentiate between the correct value and the not correct value. But this will require hiring a PhD student and doing it. And the problem is this is not one degeneracy. We will see many, many degeneracies, actually an infinite number of them, which means you need to start hiring 5, 10, 15 PhD students. Eventually, you can't do this anymore. What we do is we want to see how in the median case, how well an analysis performs. We need to do the whole analysis many, many number of times to see how it works on average. And this is too expensive, so we create this data set, but that is a representative data set. And the name is inspired by Isaac Asimov's story where, I forget the name of the story, but there's this guy, instead of having a full democracy, they have one guy who votes, who is the most representative of the country. So that's the idea, that you take one very representative data set. Right, so the solution could be, and this is something we studied, is to move away from using these off-the-shelf classifiers and use physics-aware neural networks directly for the inference. The idea here would also be to take advantage of further information we can get from the simulator that we can never get for real data. And most importantly, make the neural network aware of the Lagrangian parameter and how changing the value of the Lagrangian in this mathematical expression affects the physics on the ground. And in fact, if you change the Lagrangian a little bit, it's not like all the 50 input features will change randomly. It's actually the changes will be restricted to a much lower dimensional manifold. And if you give this information to the network, then of course it's going to be easier for it to learn to do inference. And in particular for our case, it means that it will know the effects of quantum interference. And And a bonus is that you can also train on uncertainties, which is like, for example, in a, some features you might be more confident about. Your weighing scale might be more precise than your ruler. So then you can give this information also to the model. And so what do I mean by extracting additional information from the neural network? So let's look at an analogy. If I had to do a dog picture classification, if I had to train a model to classify dogs, would you give this picture a true label of 1 or 0?
Zero.
Zero. Right. So I think I would. Right. It looks like a dog to me. Okay. I would give this a true label of, let's say, 0.7. Okay, because I can't be certain it's not a dog. It looks kind of like a dog, but we can't do this in regular data sets because we just we don't know what the true probability of a picture being a dog is. But in a usual classification problem, you have like labels that are zeros and ones, whereas the neural network is learning a much more complicated decision function. But in our case, we can find labels that are, they're not perfect, but they're much closer to the decision function we need. We need the network to learn. And that's the information we get from the simulator. And what does that mean? Well, in this equation, we saw earlier that like we build from theory parameters all the way to the detector effects. We simulate all of that. And we can't compute the whole thing analytically, but the first component we can get more information from this, and this gives us the probability. It's not, it doesn't take into account everything, but you already get labels that are better than 0 and 1s. Now, taking all of this into account, we compare this new direct inference using a neural network versus doing a typical statistical maximum likelihood estimate. So the black dots represent this new technique. It's called ELISIS, and all the other colors are baseline. And you can see that it's much more sharp, which means it's much more confident about which value is correct, and it's able to reject the other values more confidently. And that's because it knows how the physics would look at those points, whereas the other techniques are completely Lagrangian agnostic. And this allows us to set limits that are stronger and measure the parameters with more precision. These studies need to be done in particle physics. We do studies at various stages. So these techniques were proposed by the original authors on a certain data set, and we've adapted it to a different problem that's more close to what a realistic ATLAS analysis, and then we'll have to do even more realistic studies, but this looks quite promising. To conclude, making models Lagrangian aware seems to provide a significant improvement, and considering that in particle physics improvements are usually like 5%, this is quite nice to see, but it was quite a lot. And we can also train on uncertainty, but more generally, particle physics seems to be at the cusp of moving away from off-the-shelf models to much more physics-aware models. We have we're looking at like converting the entire analysis into differentiable, written in differentiable programming, and backpropagate the analysis automatically to be more optimal, or physics-inspired layers, or in fact, the symbolic regression. I think Michael talked about this is something that's cool to put inductive bias with graph neural networks, and and hopefully in the future we make even more progress and we can have some AI assisted calculations and even automation of like everything from the theory to exclusion with data and backwards if you see something explained in the data that explains with some new theory. Thank you very much.
Yeah, just.
So what we've done is for signal strength measurement, which is one parameter point for the experimental geometry. There is another approach called the detector field theory, where you take the standard model regression and add very generally additional terms that might come from the physics, and then you can do exactly the same idea of making the neural network aware of how things change the energy. And
in connection to the work that I might discuss the quantities of the element goals.
I think you might have been able to comment that.
Michael is present. Welcome.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, let's thank the speaker again. And so the next speaker is, actually, I don't know how to properly pronounce, so maybe I'll let the speaker introduce himself. Not to embarrass myself, I will try to resurrect the video. So just give me a second. So with all the shuffling here, we lost the video.
So sorry, I just muted you. There was a little bit of a humming noise. I'll stop sharing. So feel free to share your screen. You can unmute yourself. Camera,
yep.
Is working.
Yes.
Please, it's your floor. Thank you.
All right. Can you hear me well?
All too well.
There has been a lot of feedback.
Okay, I'll try turning my mic down a little bit. Is this better?
Yeah.
All right, great. Right, then I'll start. So I'm Solrun. I'm a PhD student at Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden. And I'm going to tell you about work I've been doing with my supervisors, Moa and Nick, on big theory exploration. So I'm going to start by showing you a demo of our theory exploration tool, which is called RoughSpec. And so it's a theory exploration tool that automatically generates conjectures about a given set of data types and functions. So here we have some Haskell code. We have this data type BST that defines a binary search tree. And we have some operations on our trees, for insertion, deletion, union, and finding a value for a given key. And now we want to discover some properties about these operations. So to use our tool, we define a signature where we include the functions that we're interested in exploring. And here we also have some background functions that we want our system to know about, but we're not interested in discovering properties only about those. And we also have a set of templates. So now we're only going to search for properties that fit the given templates. And these are some templates that describe shapes of properties we might like to see, like fixed point properties, left and right identity elements, commutativity, distributivity, associativity. And you see that the templates are written
So Loon is frozen, and I don't know if the problem is on our side or on her side.
I can see your camera.
On our tool, on this signature. There you go.
Like the seconds of your presentation.
Excuse me?
We lost a little bit of your presentation, so you were frozen for a little bit. Maybe 20 seconds, so I think it's fine.
All right. So here I've just run our tool on our tree data type in the given tree operations with that list of templates you could see. And it spits out these here 11 conjectures. So we see that the empty tree is a fixed point for delete, and it's also an identity element, left and right identity element for the union operation. Keys over union is commutative. It doesn't matter in what order we delete from our tree. Insertion and deletion distribute over union. Union is associative, as is insertion and deletion composed with union. Now suppose we have maybe a library, or we have a set of great proof techniques for lists. And we have this toList operation that changes our binary tree to a list. So if we can discover some properties that relate our binary tree operations to corresponding list operations, then we can use our list proofs to prove properties of our tree operations. And using these templates, we can really target them to specific property shapes. So now, instead of the previous set of sort of generic templates, we're going to try using these templates that sort of contain this toList operation and relate a tree operation to a corresponding list operation. And if we run this, it quickly spits out these 5 properties. And now we might be able to use our library of list proofs to prove properties of our tree operations. All right, so that was a little demo of what this tool looks like and what it does. So a little more background or motivation for why we're developing this tool. So we want to be able to automatically discover interesting properties about functions and data types. That's what we want to do with theory exploration. And now we might want to use these properties as lemmas in our proofs to make our automated proof techniques more powerful. Or maybe we just want to understand our mathematical theories or our software programs better. And this is also through a way of auto-generating a software specification. And previously, our group has a tool called QuickSpec, which exhaustively generates conjectures, exhaustively generates terms up to a given size and generates conjectures in that way. And which we found to be pretty useful. But when the theories or the number of functions that we're exploring gets larger, its search space gets exponentially larger and it becomes sort of too slow to be useful. It can produce an overwhelming amount of output and it might produce output that's not so interesting for the user to see or not so useful. So we developed this new approach where we only search for properties or conjectures fitting specific templates. And we very significantly reduce our search space and make theory exploration more tractable. So here, instead of using heuristics sort of to define which properties are interesting, we leave it more open to the user to define what kinds of properties they're looking for. So here is a high-level overview of how this tool works. We have a program containing some data types and functions. We have a set of templates for conjectures. And we sort of fill the holes in our templates using the function symbols and scope to create candidate conjectures. And then we use testing to rule out the easily falsifiable conjectures and present the remaining conjectures to the user as something that we think might be provably true. So to go into a little more detail, our templates are expressed in simple term language. We have meta variables representing holes to be filled with a function symbol, and we denote them by a question mark followed by a string label. And we have variables. That have names starting with a capital letter. And we can also include function symbols from our signature in the templates themselves. So here are some examples. And here in the lower one, we can see that we were able to include the specific function symbol to list in our template. So the candidate conjectures are then formed by filling the holes in the template using the function symbols and scope to form a well-typed equation. So for example, if we have this template describing how two functions f and g commute, and say we have our binary tree type and the operations insert and delete, then we generate three candidate conjectures. Where we've sort of replaced question mark F and question mark G with either insert applied to a value or delete applied to a value. We then test our candidate conjectures using property-based testing, specifically the Haskell tool QuickCheck. We discard falsified candidate conjectures and candidates where no counterexample was found are presented to the user. So for example, of those three candidate conjectures on the previous slide, two of them would be falsified. That's to say, we find counterexamples that occurs if we try to, in the first one, insert two different values with the same key, then the second insertion overwrites the first one, so we end up with different things on the left and right hand side in that case. And the second one, if we try to delete a key after inserting a value for that key, obviously it'll end up being removed from our tree, but if we insert it after deleting it, say when we have the same key, then on the right hand side, it would end up containing a value for that key. However, for deletion, it doesn't matter in what order we delete from our tree. So this third candidate conjecture ends up being output by the system, as you saw in the demo. Now, we also have some pruning. We want to prune away redundant conjectures, both to avoid cluttering the output and to save time, not waste time testing those conjectures. So most properties that can be proved by rewriting of previously discovered properties are pruned away. But since we are generating properties based on the user's wishes, we also don't want to be too aggressive in our pruning. So it's kind of a delicate balance. We also automatically expand our templates a little bit to make them a little bit more general and help the user avoid having to type up multiple nearly identical templates. We saw examples of that in the demo. So instead of filling a hole with one function symbol, we can use a nested composition of two function symbols. For example, here we have a nested composition of keys and union matching the whole question mark F. And we can also fill a hole with the partially applied function. For example, here, the whole question mark F is filled by delete applied to X. But here we also kind of put ourselves in danger of maybe going too far and generating uninteresting properties. So it is a kind of tricky balance. Now we've been focusing on rough spec as this conjecture generation tool, but we want to think of it also as a component in a larger theorem proving infrastructure. So we can send our generated conjectures to an external theorem prover to try to prove them, and this it's something we've done with our previous tool, QuickSpec. We also have Hipster, which is an Isabel theory exploration tool that uses QuickSpec to generate lemmas and then also automatically proves them. So it generates and proves lemmas for a given Isabel theory. And we think that with our targeted template-based generation in RoughSpec, that could be very useful in a theorem-proving context to quickly generate useful lemmas if we use the right templates. And that's sort of the big challenge we're facing that I would be interested in hearing some feedback or advice about from this audience if you have any thoughts. So can we use data-driven methods to learn useful templates for a given context instead of just having a human user type up the templates? So we want to try to learn common lemma shapes from proof libraries. So if you have any ideas about methods that could be useful for that or data sets that might be interesting to look at in experiments with that, I would love to hear about it. And then we want to be able to generate useful templates based on properties of the theorems we want to prove, based on what we've learned then from these libraries of proofs, either using some kind of machine learning or some heuristics. We're also interested in trying to extract templates from failed proof attempts. If maybe those failed proofs will give us some clues as to what kind of lemmas we're missing to be able to prove the relevant theorem. That concludes this talk. We have our software available on GitHub if you're interested in downloading it or having a look. And thank you very much.
So thank you for the very interesting talk. I think this conjecturing, it's like a $1 million question. I think a lot of people would like to do that, but it's a really hard problem. So I'm sure there will be some questions and suggestions. I don't see anyone online.
People online have an answer to how to create templates.
Thibaut, templates, conjecture templates.
For one, I could ask some questions.
It's not really about machine learning, but if you focus on a library, you might be able to extract some patterns by abstracting over a different structures. I mean, forgetting, for example, about the name of the constants, or so you get some shapes out of that, and you can do some statistics saying, well, this shape occurs very frequently. Maybe that's a useful pattern or not. And you can also try to map constants between, try to recognize which constants are the same, but that's some ideas about some kind of anti-unification thing where just have an algorithm that kind of try to find a general form for two different theorems that doesn't look similar at first, but with some messaging kind of make it into a similar shape. Mm-hmm. I just an idea, and maybe.
Great, yeah, thank you.
Okay, there is a question in text by Yutaka, so I'll just read that. So he's saying, how many templates do you have now? And he's also saying that he's doing something very similar this month.
Okay, let's see, where do I see the chat window? Right, so how many templates we have right now? Not so many, really. We've mostly been experimenting a bit with both, trying to define some general patterns, distributivity and associativity, and see how far we can get with that. And then also seeing where we can try with more kind of targeted specific templates. So I'd say the number of templates I've played with is some probably double digit number. I'm be interested to hear about your work.
I only have like 7 or 6, 8. Okay. I don't know. I'm pretty sure it's single digit number. Uh-huh. It's like commutativity, associativity, distributivity, and identity element, and inverse element, and homomorphism,
uh-huh.
and a couple more, but not much. Yeah, but I think I got the same impression. So I started working on bottom-up conjecturing recently, mm-hmm. and I noticed that usually we need same kind of conjectures like associativity. So I knew that people in Chalmers or Sweden are working on like theory exploration.
Right, yeah, that's us. Yeah.
But like, we almost always need associativity, for example. So mm-hmm. why just don't we make lemma? Because we know that we quite often need them. So that's why I was working on something quite uh-huh. similar this month. So I was surprised
uh-huh.
listening yeah. at all. Thanks. Yeah, okay. It was more or less.
Do we have any more questions from? There is a question in the background, so I'll ask you to come forward. It's the job right here.
The question is, I'm not sure if I have missed it, but is there some evaluation of what the formulas are found given some template? So given some template, you can be interested in whether this template actually helped you find anything more interesting than without using the template or with using some other template. So do you have any way of evaluating that in any way?
So do you mean like evaluating, right, comparing which template is more useful than another one or?
Yeah.
No, I guess so far, and we've mostly just seen sort of which ones generate a larger number of properties. And well, also sort of if they come up with something that another template could have come up with the exact same property. But we haven't really evaluated sort of what are the most useful conjectures to come out in any.
Templates are really, at least the templates that were shown in the slides were really small trees. So if you want to search for really useful trees, you could just do some brutal search of all possible small trees. And if you have some automated way of evaluating that, then presumably you could find some useful templates this way, just by evaluating a lot of small trees.
Right.
There is another comment by Stanislav about theorems for free. So there is apparently a tool by Philip Wandler coming up with theorems for polymorphic functions. So it sounds like a suggestion. You might be aware of that.
Right. I'm sort of aware of that paper, but I haven't really considered it so much in relation to this work. So yeah, thanks.
There's this whole line of research. I mean, I haven't looked at it for a while, but there's this very old tool called DICOM, which was trying to infer specifications from the runs, right? So you also mentioned this application of generating specification from source code. And this was like a really nice idea that you just like run the code and run, and you observe what's happening and you try to infer some specifications that
might hold for whatever runs that you have observed. Obviously, it might be fallible that you just didn't observe enough or whatever. But that's and I know that some people have been following up this work because of software testing. But it sounds also like you maybe like the stuff you've been doing could be integrated with this kind of more operational semantics philosophy. I mean, this is probably more just a food for thought rather than a question. There's one more question by Yutaka. He's asking if you can predict dependencies among conjectures. For example, conjecture A1 from template A is going to be useful to prove conjecture B1 from template B.
No, we don't have a way of predicting that. I mean, can
he's see also saying he doesn't know how to.
It comes as a result of another with rewriting, but yes, no.
Okay. Any more questions? I mean, we've got plenty of questions. An interesting topic, obviously. If not, then let's thank the speaker again. Now the next speaker is Jesse Han. He is going to be talk about cubing for SAT solvers. So this is a fairly hot topic in SAT solvers. So Marianne Hoyle is frequently in the news. Even my mom was actually asking me about these conjectures last week. I don't know where she found it. So.